welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and want to improve your game, this podcast is for you. Whether it's technique, strategy, equipment, or the mental game, tennis professional Ian Westerman is here to make you a better player. And now, here's Ian.
Hi, and welcome to episode number 21 of the Essential Tennis Podcast. Do you want to be more successful at your tennis game? Do you want to be able to hit shots that you're not able to now? Do you want to win more points and more matches? Do you want to beat people that you're not able to now? They beat you. Well, I know you do because you're listening to me right now. You've downloaded the podcast. You're taking the time to listen to the podcast. And you're investing in your tennis game. That's the first step to success. When you start to search out and try to find information that can help your game and put the time in to both learn and understand and then take that understanding to the tennis court and work on your game, that's how you improve. That's how you become a better tennis player, is through better understanding and through hard work and practice. The Essential Tennis Podcast is here to take care of that first part of the equation. Of course, it's still up to you to take the good information you get here and implement it into your game. But I'm giving you the information. I'm giving you the knowledge that you need to go out and become a better player. That's why the Essential Tennis Podcast is here, to give you good information to help you improve and become a better tennis player. Every week, more and more people are improving their game by listening to this podcast. And I want to thank you for joining me today and doing the same. If I can ever help you in any part of your game, whether it's your technique or your mental game, strategy, fitness, or maybe your equipment selections, you can always feel free to contact me by going to essentialtennis.com and going to the feedback page and leaving me a message there. Also, feel free to go to the Essential Tennis forums at essentialtennis.com as well. That's a great place to go and talk about your tennis issues and get information and talk to other tennis enthusiasts like yourself. Today we've got a great show. We're going to have Dr. Jack back on the program, where we're going to talk about shoulder injuries and strengthening your shoulder to improve your tennis and to avoid injury in the first place. I'm going to discuss the use of your non-dominant hand in your forehand ground stroke. I meant to get to that last podcast on Monday. However, I ran out of time. And if we have time today, we're going to talk about the age of professional tennis players. Somebody asked a question having to do with the average age of a professional tennis player. So if we have time today, we will get to that as well.
And now, it's time for Essential Tennis Sports Medicine Talk with Dr. Jack Kripsack.
Hi, Dr. Jack. How are you?
Good, Ian. And yourself?
Great. I'm getting settled in our new place here. I've got my own room with the computer and the mic now, so I can shut the door and kind of have my own little recording studio, which I'm enjoying. So it's good to talk to you again. I'm glad you're back and back on the podcast.
Oh, I'm glad to be back also, Ian, and best wishes with the new digs. It's always exciting to move into a new place. It's really great. Best of luck to you. Best wishes.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, what do you say we get down to business? I've got a question here from Kent in Ohio, and he's got some shoulder problems. What do you say we help him out?
Oh, let's give it a whirl.
All right, he says, Dr. Jack, my question is related to shoulder problems. I'm a 33-year-old and play tennis once or twice a week. For 20-plus years, I was a competitive goalkeeper in soccer, lots of landing on my shoulders, etc. Anyway, for the last 10 years or so at least, I've had a bit of grinding and some clicking, in quotations, in my right shoulder, which is my tennis arm. This is noticeable primarily during movements like windmilling my arm. I guess I would assume that's probably his serve, etc. And since I've been playing a lot more tennis this summer, I've noticed it seems to be slightly more noticeable. The only pain I've ever had in my shoulder has been muscle pain around the joint and upper back, usually the day after a long match. So my question is this: if I have no pain and haven't had pain, should I be concerned? And secondly, if I ever have to explore surgery, can most shoulder surgeries allow for complete tennis-related recoveries? So what do you think, Dr. Jack?
Well, you know, it's an interesting case. Shoulder injuries are very common in tennis, as in a lot of other overhead, what we call overhead sports. Baseball, especially the pitchers, volleyball players with their serve, swimming, freestyle. And here's one: if you sleep with your arm over your head at night, this can become a problem also, because
I've actually woken up with shoulder pain after having my arm like over my forehead.
I know, and you know, it's so funny because patients will come in and say, "Well, I don't play any of those sports," and they'll have all these shoulder symptoms. But they, do you sleep with that arm over your head at night? And they'll say, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do." And what happens is you develop something called an impingement syndrome, where as you lift your arm up, the arm's a ball and socket joint, and as you lift the arm up, the supraspinatus muscle, which is one of your rotator cuff muscles, which is responsible for lifting your arm over your head, it gets trapped between two bones, the ball or the humeral head, which is the ball in your arm, and the socket, which is a little projection off your shoulder blade, which forms part of the shoulder joint. And then there's a bone called the acromion process, which comes off your shoulder and attaches to your collarbone.
Okay.
And under that acromion process and the ball is the space where the supraspinatus muscle glides. And as you bring your arm up, that space can diminish and cause friction on that supraspinatus muscle. So every time you lift your arm up, if all your rotator cuff muscles are not properly balanced, then you can get this impingement or pinching of that supraspinatus tendon or muscle in that area.
I see.
And this is where you can get your problems. Now, the interesting thing with Kent here is that he says he doesn't have pain.
Right.
So Kent, do you have to be worried about this? Well, yes and no. You have to be worried because you're having some clicking, and this can be an early sign of something that's going to become a problem down the line. So getting it addressed now would be very beneficial.
Okay.
But it doesn't sound to me like anything that's going to need surgery at this point.
All right.
Surgeries will be if you tear that supraspinatus muscle, and then you can't lift your arm at all, and it has to be surgically stitched up. Or if this imbalance of musculature causes a shearing or grinding force inside that ball and socket, then the cartilage in the socket, known as the glenoid labrum, can form a tear in it, and it's known as something called a SLAP lesion, which stands for superior labral anterior posterior. It's a horizontal tear in that cartilage, which would require surgical stitching, and that can be somewhat of a pain to recover from, but certainly you can recover from it, and it shouldn't affect your ability to continue to play tennis, especially on a recreational or recreationally competitive level.
Okay.
Even if you had this, you would be able to get back to teaching and competing without much of a problem. There's a guy that I know that I used to take lessons from down in Hilton Head, and he had this surgery, and he came back and played fine and without any problems. So it's not the kind of thing that if you catch it early enough, or even if you delay a little while, that shouldn't prohibit you from being able to continue to play.
Okay, so basically at this point, it doesn't sound like it's a major problem. However, if he doesn't take care of it, it could definitely turn into something serious?
Correct. And, you know, one of the basis for this is going to be physical therapy or proper training of the muscle.
Okay.
And again, going back to that website we talked about before at the American Sports Medicine Institute, the ASMI.org website, and doing those throwers 10 exercises.
Yeah.
It's money. Those are just money to do those exercises if you're a tennis player. Just very, very important, because if you just keep going out there and hitting power serves and just doing bench presses all the time and bicep curls and not allowing a proper balance of your musculature, then you're going to run into problems. Another thing to look at, which Ken should definitely have addressed with his regular physician, is to make sure that his scapula or shoulder blades move properly. And to test this, what you do is put your arms out to the side and bring them up over your head so the backs of your hands touch over your head.
Okay.
And as you do this, someone behind you watches and sees how your shoulder blades move. And they should rhythmically come out to the side and elevate symmetrically.
Okay.
And if one side gets hung up or locked up, then that can be a problem with something in your spine, in your thoracic spine, the bones in your middle back. They can have a problem with them, or you can have some arthritis in your shoulder, or some type of muscle imbalance that doesn't allow that shoulder blade to move properly, and then that's going to perpetuate some of the problems in the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And again, with proper physical therapy, that's pretty easy to correct, and that can help help correct the situation.
Okay.
If someone with these ever gets what they call a dead arm, where you feel like your arm just, you know, has no more velocity on it, like you can hit a serve, but it just has no kick to it, it just feels like kind of like it's dead, not numb, but just weak and dead, then again, that's going to speak to one of those labral tears.
Okay.
And again, if these things are left unaddressed and you start to develop some arthritis in there and then you find yourself not moving your arm through a full range of motion because of pain, then you can develop what's called a frozen shoulder or adhesive capsulitis. And the less you move the shoulder, the less you're going to be able to move the shoulder as it gets frozen. So you won't be able to lift your arm over your head anymore, and then you'll end up with your elbow out at the side, barely being able to comb your hair.
No, that's not good.
No, not at all. So this is definitely something you need to address to keep a full range of motion, keep that joint moving, and keep the muscle balance in its proper yin-yang balance.
Okay. So for what Kent has told us so far, can you give us some examples of some exercises we can do to keep the balance in there in the shoulder?
Sure. Again, those throwers tendon, and a couple of the most important ones are what we call the internal and external rotators.
Uh-huh.
And all you need for this is a piece of exercise tubing,
mm-hmm.
which you have at mid-chest height, and you take the tubing, attach it maybe to a doorknob or something on the wall, and hold it in your hand, and with your wrist nice and firm, you pull your arm inward. So your elbow's bent at 90 degrees and your arm is tucked in to the side. The band is going towards the door and you pull your fist holding the band into your stomach.
Okay.
And then you let it come out to 90 degrees. You don't want it to go all the way out towards the wall and open up more than 90 degrees because, again, getting it from, say, 130 to 90 is going to irritate your deltoid muscle and your deltoid bursa, and then you'll end up with a deltoid bursitis. So you're going from 90 degrees, tucking into the belly, coming out 90 degrees, tucking into the belly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you flip and turn around the other way so that your hand starts tucked in against your belly, like the famous Brady tuck with New England and the Raiders. Being a big Raiders fan, that's always been a bone of contention with me. So you start with your hand tucked in and then bring it out to 90 degrees.
Okay.
Allow it to come back in and bring it out. And then you flip the tubing up so that it's above your head, and you hold your arm out to the side. You lift your arm, and what I mean by arm is the area from your shoulder to the elbow, and the forearm is from the elbow to the wrist. So your arm will be raised 90 degrees horizontal with the floor,
mm-hmm.
and then your elbow is bent 90 degrees, so it's like a slot machine arm. And you pull your arm down. You don't pull it forward like you're throwing a baseball, but you just drop your arm down. You drop your forearm down like a slot machine lever.
Okay.
So that the arm itself stays horizontal and acts as a pivot point, and you just drop the arm down.
Okay.
And then let it come back. And then the last one to keep the balance is then you move the tubing down so it's on the floor, and your hand is down, and you lift it up so that it's facing straight to the sky, your wrist.
Gotcha.
And then let it go down and bring it back up. And those are probably the four easiest and most basic exercises you can do. And then if you go to the website, you'll see some others. But just doing those internal and external rotators, easy to add during your usual workout routine, easy to do at home, and they're, again, really money. They're excellent exercises to do.
Okay, great. All right, well, Kent, hopefully that answers your question. And I hope that you can strengthen that part of your body and make it stronger and feel better soon. If you have any further questions for Dr. Jack having to do with your shoulder or anything else for that matter, anybody else listening, you can either email me directly or go to the forums at EssentialTennis.com, where Dr. Jack has his own section where you can ask him questions having to do with your tennis game and any kind of injury or other problems that you might have. Anything else to add, Jack, before we wrap up?
No, I think it's pretty straightforward. Ken, I'd love to know how you made out once you see your regular physician. So if you don't mind, drop me a line. You have my email address, and I'd love to know how you make out. Good luck.
All right, great. Well, Dr. Jack, thanks for joining us once again, and thank you for your expertise and the great information that you're providing for the Essential Tennis listeners.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian, and don't let your wife spend all your hard-earned money at Pottery Barn, okay?
I can't guarantee that, but I'm going to try hard.
Okay, good deal. Right. Listen, you take care. Best of luck.
All right, thank you. You take care, too.
The Essential Tennis Podcast is brought to you by
Bridgewater Medical Group is a multi-specialty medical group located in Bridgewater, New Jersey, and is your home for primary care, gastroenterology, sports medicine, and general internal medicine. They offer a broad array of on-site, state-of-the-art services to make your healthcare experience more pleasurable. Scheduled appointments are preferred, but physician assistants are available for walk-in care. For more information, call Bridgewater Medical Group at 908-722-0808.
For more information on sponsors of the Essential Tennis Podcast or to become a sponsor, visit www.essentialtennis.com. And now it's time for Essential Tennis Q&A.
Okay, let's discuss the use of your non-dominant hand and arm in your forehand groundstroke. This topic was brought to us by Mike in New Jersey. He's a 3.0 player. And his message to me was, "Hey, Ian, could you discuss the position and use of the non-dominant arm before, during, and after a forehand groundstroke? Thanks a bunch, Mike." Well, Mike, we're going to discuss today what you should be doing with your non-dominant hand in your ready position, what your hand and arm should be doing in preparing you for your swing, what it should be doing during the swing itself, and also what it should do as you follow through. So we're going to fully discuss what your non-dominant arm and hand should be doing during your forehand. Let's go ahead and start off with ready position. What your non-dominant hand is going to be doing is going to vary depending on if you have a one-handed backhand or a two-handed backhand. I asked Mike which he had, and he said he has a one-handed backhand. If that's the case, most higher-level players in their ready position have their non-dominant hand kind of spread out across the throat of the racket, which is between the head of the racket and the handle or the grip. This is where I like to keep my right hand. I'm left-handed. This is where I keep my opposite hand is on the throat of the racket. I like to keep it there because it helps maneuver the racket as I move it to position it for different strokes, and it's just a good, comfortable place to put it. It's what I've always been used to. So if you have a one-handed backhand, your opposite hand should be on the throat of the racket. If you have a two-handed backhand, your opposite hand, your non-dominant hand, should be above your dominant hand and waiting in a backhand grip, so that if the ball does come to your backhand side, you don't have to mess with getting two hands in position in the correct grip. You already have your opposite hand in a backhand grip, and all you have to do is switch your dominant hand to whatever grip you normally use for your backhand ground stroke. Now, all of these things that we're going to discuss about this topic, to a certain degree, are personal preference. Certainly, you can use your non-dominant hand and arm in different ways and still hit a high-quality shot. What I'm going to say and the different things that I'm going to talk to you about today are typical of a high-level player. There's definitely a pattern of how upper-level players use their non-dominant arm and hand during their forehand groundstroke. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, and that's what I'm going to give you information about. I follow this pattern, what I'm going to discuss today, and I often teach it as well to my students. It's something that I feel is a good method to follow. But again, it doesn't have to be this way. It's to a certain degree kind of a style and a personal preference issue. But I definitely believe in what I'm going to talk about today for myself. It's what I'm comfortable in doing and the way that I've developed throughout the years. So we've talked about ready position, both for a one-handed backhand and a two-handed backhand. Now let's talk about actually preparing your body for the stroke. Your non-dominant arm and hand should be aiding in your core rotation and setting up for your forehand ground stroke. So whether you have a one-handed backhand or a two-handed backhand, your non-dominant hand is above your dominant hand on the racket. From your ready position with both your hands in front of you and your racket in front of you in a comfortable position, you should be using your non-dominant hand and arm to push your racket, your shoulders, your core. Everything should turn together as one piece to your dominant side as you set up for your forehand ground stroke. So if you're right-handed, your left hand is going to push your ready position to the right and rotate your body as a whole to the right, 90 degrees. As this happens, you should be using your opposite hand to lift the racket up, only to about shoulder height or so. And both your hands should remain on the racket as you push the racket back and make your core rotation, turning your body to the side. I find that keeping my hand on the throat of the racket aids in positioning the racket to the right spot, and it helps me in my awareness of my racket. I can literally feel with my opposite hand where the racket is as I'm setting up. If it's a higher ball or a lower ball, I can position my racket accordingly to adjust for the height of the ball. And also I can adjust by feel with my opposite hand the racket face. If I'm trying to hit a heavier topspin shot or a flatter shot, I can feel as I'm watching the oncoming ball with my opposite hand exactly what angle my racket face is at. So I find that keeping your opposite hand on the racket as you rotate your body to the side helps aid in awareness, and it also helps make a full rotation with your body by keeping your opposite hand on the racket and pushing your racket and your shoulders and your core all to the side, not at least 90 degrees as a whole. You should be rotating your entire core to the side to prepare for the oncoming ball so that you're ready to use your entire body to make your swing. Now on to the swing itself. Your opposite hand should not stay on the racket the entire time. You want to use your opposite hand and arm to push the racket back to prepare your body. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that it stay on the racket the entire time until you're actually ready to swing. Once you've gotten yourself turned to the side and you're comfortable with where your racket is and where the racket face is, at that point, I would take my hand off the racket and prepare to start rotating back forwards again into the stroke. And in most, if not all, high-level professional players, the opposite hand and arm is initiating the forward rotation with the core and body. And I kind of knew this already just through my teaching, but just to make sure, just to confirm what I suspected, I went ahead and looked at slow motion video of a couple different professional players. I watched Roger Federer, of course, hit a slow motion forehand, and I watched Roddick before as I was making notes to answer this question. They both have very, very similar swings in terms of how they use their opposite hand. After they've made their rotation and as they start to drop their racket to make the swing at the ball, both their left hands and arms initiate their core rotation by starting to pull their body, I'm sorry, by starting to pull their arm out to the side to start unwinding their core. So the their opposite hand is beginning the uncoil of their upper body and their lower body by leading their rotation forwards towards the ball. And so the opposite hand and arm that was a second ago right in front of your chest is now moving out to the left and out to the side to begin your rotation into the ball. Every tennis stroke needs to be strengthened by a good core movement, by using your body wisely, because it's the strongest part of your body, using your chest, your shoulders, your back, your hips. Your core needs to be used in just about every swing in tennis, and the forehand is certainly no exception. And so, first of all, taking the racket back with your opposite hand helps make a good initial rotation to prepare your body. And then by using your opposite hand and arm to initiate the forward swing, you can ensure a good rotation back again through the point of contact and into the ball. So that's how you use your opposite arm to actually aid in your forehand swing. Now, both Roger and Roddick, as they follow through, tuck their opposite hand and arm up close to their body. Their arm bends. And they tuck their arm in kind of close to their body, a lot like on a serve, to help their body continue to rotate without their arm being straight out and kind of flailing around. So it's a way to continue the rotation out to the left without the arm getting in the way. So their arm is initiating the rotation forwards and then kind of tucking in next to their core as they make contact, and then kind of staying there as the racket continues on past contact, and then up and either staying up by the shoulder or coming back down and around, depending on what type of shot they've just hit. So, Mike, that's my answer to your question. Again, what I'm describing is the way most professional players do it and the way most upper-level players do it, 4-5 or 5-0 plus players. This is the way a lot of modern players are hitting their forehands in terms of the usage of their non-dominant arm. As I said before, this is to some degree personal preference, and I want you to do what's comfortable to you. But this is the way most good players are doing it these days, and it's what I have developed as well, and it's what I'm comfortable with. Hopefully that answers your question, Mike. If you have anything further on that, feel free to let me know. All right, that brings Essential Tennis Podcast number 21 to a close. Hopefully you've enjoyed the show today. Sorry we didn't get to our last topic there, but we're all out of time. I'm releasing this podcast today early. It's currently the 13th of August, which is Wednesday night. I'm not going to be around tomorrow night because there's a professional tennis tournament in town here in the DC area. It's the Leg Mason tennis tournament, and I'm going to watch tomorrow night, and I'll probably be gone most of the night. So I'm looking forward to that a lot. So got everything together quickly and decided to release the podcast a night early. I'm sure you guys won't mind. So the rest of this week, guys, I hope you're all doing great with your tennis. I'd love to hear from you, whether you are or not. Let me know if I can help you out in any way. And I will look forward to releasing another podcast this coming Monday. Until then, good luck with your tennis, and take care, everybody.